Welcome to the Anxiety Summit Season 2. As you know, I'm your host, Trudy Scott. I'm a food mood expert, I'm a certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. And today we are talking about part 2 of Mercury Burden. The topic is Your Hidden Mercury Burden, a Likely Root Cause of the Other Root Causes of Anxiety. And this is part 2 because our wonderful speaker, Chris Homme, had so much information to share that we decided to split it into 2 parts. You are here, Chris?
Yes.
Great. Very, very big welcome to part 2. And just a little recap of what we covered in part 1. Be sure to go back and listen to this. We talked about chronic mercury poisoning being the root cause of these other causes of anxiety and some of the specifics on how it can affect digestion, GABA levels, serotonin levels, food intolerances, hormone imbalances, and a host of other factors. And then we talked about why, if we know mercury so bad, haven't our health officials worked to ban mercury from dentistry and flu vaccines and having fish tested? And then we also talked about how do you know if you have a hidden mercury burden. So I'm going to quickly read Chris's bio in case you missed that call, but I encourage you to go back and listen to it. And then we'll go right into the rest of the topics for part 2. So Chris Homme is a retired engineer turned science writer. She has graduate degrees in public policy and public health. She has chronic mercury poisoning, and she's the lead author of a peer-reviewed journal article entitled New Science Challenges Old Notion That Mercury Dental Amalgam is Safe, published in Biometals in February 2014, which describes the new science of genetic susceptibilities to low-dose exposures of mercury. She facilitates a chronic mercury poisoning support group in the San Francisco Bay Area. As an activist, she is party to the ongoing legal effort to compel the FDA to restrict mercury dental amalgam. And in 2013, she led a campaign in the city of Berkeley to improve the information given to dental patients about the risks of mercury dental amalgam. Learn more at mercuryandmore.weebly.com. And all the this website and the other ones that we're going to be mentioning in the resources will be available on a blog post that we tie directly to this interview and the other interview. Are we ready to get going on the second part?
Yes. Thank
so
you,
let's
Trudy.
Talk about how someone can get rid of their mercury burden, which I know is a tough question.
Yes, it's a very difficult question, and that's why I really like to emphasize the toxicity of mercury and just how insidious it is and how important prevention is, because once you have toxicity, it can be pretty hard to get rid of. So the first thing to do is address your exposures, and one big one is dental amalgams. So if you are inclined to think you may have a mercury burden, then consider safe dental amalgam removal. It's not an emergency, but put it into your 5-year plan. You can read the IAOMT website. That's the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. They're the pro-science dental association that has been working to fund and disseminate the science since 1983. They have developed a safe amalgam removal protocol, so you can read about that. You can find a dentist who appreciates the toxicity of mercury and takes every precaution. Your old dentist may have an office full of mercury vapor, so you may want to find a new dentist. And discuss the details of the procedure with the new dentist and decide for yourself whether the procedure is adequate. You got into trouble by trusting your old dentist to do what the old dentist thought was right, so it's a good idea not to trust, but to figure out what you think is the right protocol for amalgam removal. And by the way, if you believe that your dental amalgams have affected your health, please report this to the FDA on the FDA MedWatch website. They have a form to report adverse events, and dental amalgams are considered a medical device, so if you'll use that form, it may help. In the last go-around against the FDA's amalgam rule, the 2009 statement by the FDA said that they had received very few adverse event reports on amalgam. So let's not let them say that again.
Great. Thank you. And I did not know about this ability to report that you're having an adverse effect. It's good to know. Thank you for sharing that. And we could do a whole talk just on this topic. So we're just touching the surface here. And as Chris says, do your homework, find someone who can help if you feel like that's what you want to do. I actually found someone in Colorado Springs. I did a lot of research before I worked with them. I asked a lot of questions, and then I went ahead and had all of mine removed. So you do want to do it safely. Really, really important factor.
Yes.
So we've covered dental amalgams. What about fish, Chris?
Yes, the other big exposure is fish, and this is controversial too. The two main points that I'd like your listeners to realize are, first, that the government standards and information, both their standards and their information regarding fish mercury, are inadequate. And second, the levels of mercury in fish vary by 100-fold.
Wow, that's a lot. So we're being told to eat fish a few times a week. We're being told to eat a variety of fish and to avoid four specific species, and that's shark, swordfish, tilefish, and king mackerel. Is there a problem with this?
The problem is that it may not be enough to simply avoid those ultra-high mercury fish. You may want to avoid the medium mercury fish too.
Mm-hmm.
And the term low mercury fish is ambiguous because even the smaller type of tuna that is called low mercury has 10 times the mercury as sardines do. This is explained very well in that 2000 report by the Environmental Working Group that you gave me. Thank you, Trudy. The main message in that report is that choosing the species of fish is key because the levels of both nutrients and contaminants vary widely by species. For example, some ballpark mercury numbers are that swordfish has about 1 part per million of mercury, cod has about 0.1 parts per million, which is 10 times less than swordfish, and sardines have about 0.01 parts per million, which is 100 times less than swordfish.
That's quite a big difference, and I'm glad you mentioned the Environmental Working Group report, and we'll make sure to share a link to that on the blog that goes with this interview. They're a great resource for this type of thing, and that report was exceptionally good, so I'm glad we've mentioned that. But what the report actually said is that it's best to choose species of fish that are high in omega-3s, which makes a lot of sense, and then also very low in mercury, like the salmon and the sardines.
Yes, and there aren't very many species, so it's good to know your species.
Yep, and yay for salmon and sardines. So why do you believe that the government standards regarding fish are not good enough?
This is a technical issue that I tried to explain in my write-up, but the bottom line is that there are many reasons to think that the EPA reference dose for methylmercury ingestion is too lax. One reason has to do with just how difficult it is for a clinician to detect mercury symptoms, since most initial symptoms are subjective, like fatigue, lack of stamina, need for more downtime, and they don't count that type of symptom in such scientific studies. By the way, one of the scientists who helped develop the standard wrote a subsequent critique of the standard in which she said, quote, "It may be argued that derivation of a reference dose is inappropriate given that there does not appear to be a threshold for adverse neuropsychological effects based on available data."
Could you explain what that actually means in English? It may be argued that derivation of a reference dose is inappropriate. What does that actually mean for us?
Well, the reference dose is an attempt to set a level that would be safe or would show no obvious harm if consumed chronically for life. And she's saying that there may be no such dose, that there may be no safe threshold for mercury, that we should avoid all mercury. That is what she's saying.
Okay. And this is based...
couched in scientific qualifiers like maybe.
Right. Okay. Got it. And who's the scientist who wrote the standard? And then she wrote the...
This was Deborah Rice, an okay. EPA scientist.
Okay. Rice, R-I-C-E.
Yes.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. And how does this fit in with the idea that fish are healthy and that people have been eating all types of fish forever? As you know, there are some practitioners who are saying it's more dangerous to eat too little fish than too much. Chris Caressa is a San Francisco Bay acupuncturist who had a big blog post on this topic, and there's a number of other practitioners out there who've blogged about it. I'd love you to talk a little bit about it and the idea that selenium in the fish may be protective against mercury, and therefore we can eat unlimited amounts of any type of fish.
Yeah, I don't know where these guys get stuff like this. I mean, yeah, there are a few negative studies out there. There are always sloppy studies in which the researchers fail to find problems, but it usually boils down to the studies aren't refined enough. So making these statements for the general public strikes me as very irresponsible, especially considering the new science on genetic susceptibilities to mercury toxicity. I think the fact that some people do well on lots of fish despite the mercury has to do with the body's natural defenses, one of which is selenium, and the nonlinear nature of mercury toxicity, that you can have ongoing exposures and be fine because your natural defenses are working, but eventually your defenses can become overwhelmed and your symptoms can escalate, and it may require a large total load over a number of years to reach that point of having overt symptoms. It may require a prenatal load plus ongoing exposure to mercury and perhaps other toxicants. It may be that many of our diseases of aging actually have a mercury component. This is my suspicion. All this is very hard to study.
Okay. So we can't trust the government safety standard, and we're not sure if we've got a mercury burden. How do we decide whether to eat fish, and what is your thoughts on how much we can eat?
I believe that everyone can eat the very low mercury fish several times a week and still stay well below the EPA reference dose. I do know one mercury scientist who doesn't eat any fish at all because you never know whether it has local contamination, but I know another who does enjoy fish. Even a risk-averse mercury toxic person like me should be able to eat salmon and sardines, although I don't know much about the issue of local contamination. I stay away from the other species besides salmon and sardines,
mm-hmm.
So I only eat the super low mercury fish. And speaking of those other species, I think your listeners should know that high mercury fish are legally marketed with no point of sale warnings because the FDA standard for mercury contamination is too lax. The standard is set at 1 part per million, which is a typical level for those bad four, swordfish, shark, tilefish, and king mackerel. But maybe it doesn't matter that the standard is too lax since the standard isn't even enforced. Jane Hightower discusses this issue in her book, Diagnosis Mercury.
So what we're saying here is that these high mercury fish are not being labeled. Is that what you're saying with this no point
yeah.
of sale warning? Okay. And then what do you mean by the action level isn't even enforced? What does that mean?
Well, the FDA states what they call an action, has set what they call an action level, which is a level at which action can be taken for commercial products, but they don't actually take action.
Okay.
It's,
and when you
it's
mean
their
by taking,
safety standard.
And when you mean by taking action, you mean labeling. Is that what you mean?
No, withdrawing it from the market. It's
oh.
not legally allowed to be sold, so action can be taken to remove. Governments can remove it from the market.
Got it. Okay, great. Okay, so you're saying that's not enforced?
Right.
Okay. So
and
what
that's
do you
what Jane Hightower talks about in her book. She goes shopping with her high-end, well-to-do customers at the upper level fish markets
mm-hmm.
in San Francisco, and they find a lot of fish that's contaminated to the point that it is not legally sellable.
Okay, good to know. I'll have to check that one out. I'm not familiar with her book. Thank you. So to recap, what you're saying is that the levels of mercury in fish that we commonly see in grocery stores and restaurants vary enormously, and you said as much as 100-fold, and that
yeah.
low mercury can be ambiguous since it can be well below the standard but still not be very low, and some of us might want to choose only the very low mercury fish.
Yes, and people can find out the average mercury levels for different species of fish by searching on FDA fish mercury levels.
Okay, great. And we can provide a link to that on the blog that goes with this interview. Is that in that information in the some of the articles that you're going to be providing us?
Yes. Well, I did provide a footnote with that link to that FDA table.
Okay, great. And I'm just going back to a comment I just made. I don't know if I said it wrong, where I said low mercury can be ambiguous. Should I have said medium mercury can be ambiguous? Or have we got low mercury and very low mercury fish?
Well, I guess any of those adjectives can be ambiguous, but I think people get in trouble when they hear the term low mercury applied to something like tuna when
okay.
the speaker might be calling it low mercury relative to the albacore tuna, which is medium high. So the word that gets people in trouble is the low mercury, and we should probably develop our own terminology and say very low mercury or super low mercury just to distinguish from those so-called low mercury that aren't so low.
Okay, that's a great clarification. Thank you. So the very low mercury are the ones that you've mentioned, which is the salmon and the sardines.
Yes.
Okay, great. And so would you say that knowing that that you've got mercury toxicity, if you ate high mercury fish, would you notice it immediately, or is it going to be an insidious effect that you might not notice right away?
It's insidious. In general, the amounts are so small and the targeted biomolecules are so diffuse throughout the body and the toxicity doesn't happen until the mercury oxidizes, which may take seconds, minutes, hours. So you're not going to notice the effect from a particular meal. Rather, it's an issue of chronic long-term exposure. Although people who have a classic IgE type of allergy to mercury might notice symptoms after a meal.
Okay, very interesting. And I appreciate you sharing your perspectives. And personally, I err on the side of caution, and I don't go for the bigger fish that we know have the higher levels of mercury. I don't go for the so-called low mercury fish. I recommend and eat sardines and salmon, and that's what I recommend to my clients. And it's interesting to hear that you've got that perspective as well. I think we need to be cautious. And
yeah. Decisions about fish consumption should consider the individual. And unfortunately, some individuals should avoid most fish due to their susceptibility to its mercury content. I think it's very important to understand the insidious nature of mercury toxicity, the long latencies, the issue of overwhelming your defenses over time and then being stuck with a burden that is very hard to get rid of. So this type of toxicity really argues for the precautionary principle. But at the same time, many people seem to thrive on fish, and people can have genetic enzymes that are resistant to mercury toxicity. So we really can't generalize. And I believe that women who want to become pregnant should attempt to discern the extent of their mercury burden and their susceptibility, where they are on that continuum between health and toxicity, and they really should get the numbers for the species they may eat. I think they can eat several meals per week of the very low mercury fish like sardines and salmon, but as for other fish, it's a matter of risk tolerance. So I err on the side of avoiding that extra exposure. But actually, Trudy, I have a question for you, which is, I know the essential fats in fish are important, so what's the best way to get those if we're not eating fish and would rather have food than supplements?
Well, grass-fed red meat is one good source of omega-3s. Of course, it definitely goes to quality. We want grass-fed red meat. That's going to definitely provide us some of those omega-3s. And for some of my clients who are not fish eaters, that's what I recommend. So the next area is related to mercury pollution is industrial pollution. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Pollution is maybe a unique situation. Some people do have unfortunate exposures to industrial pollution, and Chinese coal burning is polluting our oceans and adding to the mercury levels in fish, although I understand that most of the mercury in fish is from natural sources. And some people, like you, as I recall, even played with mercury in their childhood.
Yeah.
So there can be unique exposures to mercury, but for most people, the big two are fish and amalgams. And also, actually, another big source is the prenatal burden.
And then the other thing that we want to do is educate yourself about your good diet and supplements and how those can help, because as we've talked about in part one, is we have a lot of enzymes that are blocked by mercury. We've got a higher need for some of these antioxidants to prevent this oxidative damage. We need all these cofactors that we talked about in part one, zinc and iron, magnesium, all these vitamins and minerals. We need more than the average person. And a lot of people seem to do better when they get on a special diet. Obviously, we can change how we feel by eating good food, good quality food, and adding in these supplements that we may need because of the mercury burden. So can we talk about a little bit about some of the dietary recommendations and supplements that we might talk about, and then that we might need, and then I will add in some of the things that I have experience in as well.
Yes, I might have to defer to you because my area is more mercury toxicity, and then what to do about it seems to depend on the individual. But many people find themselves on a paleo or GAPS diet due to food allergies and also a need for nutrient density. And then high fat content may be important if you do have a lot of blocked enzymes. Fats have fewer enzymes in the metabolic process. For example, coconut oil can be helpful.
Very interesting. And we're seeing a lot of people doing really well on a grain-free diet. So it's very interesting that you are saying this. And then, of course, there are these other supplements that we need to talk about. You'd mentioned antioxidants, fatty acids, minerals, and then the particular ones that you'd mentioned were magnesium and zinc and molybdenum and chromium. And then there were some for mitochondrial support like carnitine and CoQ10 as well. And my question was that I had for you was, what about adding in amino acids like GABA to raise GABA levels and tryptophan or 5-HTP to raise serotonin levels? And we talked about it, and I see so much amazing results with individual targeted amino acids. So just based on what you've shared with us and how mercury can disrupt these pathways, so you're not going to be able to make your own. You talked about damage to the Purkinje, was it the Purkinje cells you mentioned?
Yes.
So I would think that GABA and tryptophan and or 5-HTP would be very beneficial. Now, the big question is, you shouldn't need to be on these forever. You talked earlier about needing to be on supplements long-term. Ideally, if your levels are low, you should be able to take them as supplements short-term, and then getting your diet under control, you shouldn't need them any longer. And I do find some people are on them for a very long time, and they need to, and it could possibly be due to the mercury issue.
Yeah.
And then
this is your area more than mine, so
yeah.
I'm glad you're familiar with it.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've got to eat to support our detox pathways, and cruciferous vegetables are very, very beneficial, and so these are the foods that contain sulfur-containing foods. And we are, one of the experts that I am interviewing is Tom Maltaire, and he's going to talk about toxicity in general and then some of the dietary approaches that are going to help with some of the detox pathways. Is there anything else you want to add with regards to supporting detox pathways?
Well, I do know that mercury-toxic people can have odd food sensitivities, like to sulfur foods, including cruciferous vegetables. So sometimes this particular sensitivity can be addressed with supplemental molybdenum to push through the sulfite oxidase enzyme. But basically, it's good to be aware that mercury toxicity can cause idiosyncratic food sensitivities, and it's good to be aware of what foods are important for detox, but not to take that as a hard and fast rule that means you need those. You may need them, but your body may not be able to handle them. It's a dilemma that mercury people find themselves in. It's very difficult, and sometimes eventually you can muddle along and improve to the point where you can take the beneficial foods, you can tolerate them, and you can get better at a faster rate.
Okay. That's a good point that you make. So in part one, we talked about all the different ways that mercury can affect different enzyme processes and pathways and processes in the body. Now, I'm assuming that would not be applicable to everyone. You may have one person who is affected in three of the areas. Someone else may be affected in other of the areas. So here we've got this difficulty where one person who has mercury toxicity may have an issue with some of these sulfur foods and food sensitivities, and someone else may not. Would that be a fair statement?
Definitely. Mercury toxicity is very idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's so tough, because we can't say you've got mercury toxicity, this is exactly what we're going to see, and this is exactly what you need to do. Everyone is affected differently, which is how how many things affect us. Someone may have an issue with gluten and exhibit signs similar to autism. Someone else may have rheumatoid arthritis. Someone else may have anxiety and depression. So we can't just say this is the cause, this is the symptoms, this is the solution. We need to figure out what the solution is going to be for each person.
Yes.
Okay. So you shared that there's certain foods or supplements that we need to avoid other than what you've just mentioned. So can we talk about some of those that we know that are problematic?
Yes, it's especially important to be aware of the issue about dithiols, which are foods or substances containing two thiol or sulfhydryl groups. and this would be alpha lipoic acid and cilantro. These molecules are mercury chelators, but they're not perfect chelators. They grab mercury, but only loosely. They can drop it again and cause redistribution. So, for example, if you have dental amalgams and you consume alpha lipoic acid or cilantro, this can liberate mercury from your dental fillings and redistribute it into your brain. So you may not notice any problems for weeks or months until your brain's defenses are exhausted, or you may be a good excretor and not have a problem with this supplement or treatment. So it's important that people be aware of this possibility. And for example, if you take cilantro and you have brain symptoms a few hours after eating it, that's a good sign that you have mercury poisoning. But if you don't have symptoms, it may just mean that your defenses are not yet overwhelmed and you may be depleting your defenses and sending yourself on the way to toxicity. It's hard to know.
I mean, give me an example of brain symptoms, like brain fog type symptoms?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And then there's this other thiol group that we need to worry about. Talk about those.
Yes. Some people with mercury poisoning seem to have trouble with monothiols or single thiols, one sulfhydryl group. And these are sulfur foods and supplements like chlorella, N-acetylcysteine, eggs, and cruciferous vegetables. You need these sulfur foods, to make glutathione, assuming that your enzymes aren't too blocked. But if you overdo them, they seem to cause redistribution of mercury. So I think the thing to remember with mercury poisoning is that it's very idiosyncratic, and you have to figure out what your tolerances are for different food groups.
Okay, good. And let's get back to chelation. We touched on it a little bit in part one when we were talking about the testing. So let's talk about chelation now.
You know, there's no easy way to treat mercury poisoning. It's a really awful disease, and so the key is prevention. That's why I'm wary of fish. But chelation is out there. People are doing it. Take your time to learn about it. It's not for everyone. It does seem to increase mercury excretion, but it also causes redistribution, which can cause damage. And unfortunately, the sickest people are the ones who seem to have the most trouble with chelation. And by the way, the word chelation is often misused as a synonym for detoxification, but it actually means a chemical binding of two or more binding sites to form a stable ring or cage. So,
okay. And when you're talking about chelation, this is the taking the agent like DMSA or DMPS or EDTA. I actually went to a dentist who removes amalgams. This is a different dentist that I went to, and he offered me EDTA. And I remember you'd said earlier in the interview that you didn't know if EDTA was still being used, but apparently it is.
There is a concern that EDTA is contraindicated for mercury poisoning. I guess it's effective on lead and calcium, but there may be an issue about a need to try to remove mercury first. I'm not sure. Chelation is, you know, the problem is that our medical system doesn't even acknowledge chronic mercury poisoning. So here we are, those of us who have it, trying to get better and trying these various theoretical ideas like chelation, but they haven't been tested adequately because the disease itself is not yet acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really walking in a minefield to try and use these techniques.
Which is one of my concerns about even talking about this on the Anxiety Summit, because it's not something where we can say categorically, this is what we need to do. We don't actually have answers. So our main objective was to raise this awareness so we can prevent it, you know, in the future, and then also to help people who may feel that they're exposed to now start, you know, looking further and considering the fact that mercury may be an issue.
Yes, and I know, Trudy, that you really like to provide people with solutions and with ideas and help, and so nutrition and supplements really do offer that, in the sense that they can make you feel a lot better if you've had blocked enzymes from mercury, but it's important to cover these issues about chelation, because mm-hmm. people are trying these things, and for example, a lot of health practitioners offer intravenous chelation, and that can be dangerous for people who are very sick. There's a website called DMPS Backfire about people who have experienced damage from these treatments that were provided by well-intentioned practitioners. The practitioner can have good results for a number of people, but those are the people who had better genes. They were better excretors, and you might not be in that category. So oral chelation can do the same thing, probably more safely and cheaply, but it too can cause redistribution. But if you want to look into chelation, you can look into low-frequent dose oral chelation. That appears to be the most rational treatment, but even this protocol can cause redistribution and possible damage. And it's very, very slow, so it may not be much faster than doing nothing. I'm not sure. This is all a big unknown, and how well chelation works or how safely may depend mostly on your genes. I did read a study about people who had their amalgams removed due to chronic illness, and the people who reported recovering, who reported better recoveries, there was an association between their level of urinary excretion of metals before their amalgam removal. I can't remember if it was provoked urine or unprovoked urine, but the idea is that your ability to recover from mercury poisoning may depend on your basic ability to excrete it. So we really don't know to what degree chelation is helping versus would you have been excreting and detoxifying anyway without these drugs. These drugs seem to be doing things, but they are also causing damage, and it's just a big unknown. And so the real key is back to prevention. Let's get mercury out of our teeth, out of medicine, out of our industrial processes. Let's get more labeling on fish. It's that's where I'm at.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then going back to what you said, I just want to clarify, low-frequent dose oral chelation, this is the protocol that Andrew Cutler recommends, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. So we're going to talk about some resources, and he's on the top of the list of some of the resources that you recommend. So do you want to just share his information?
Yes. I recommend his book, Amalgam Illness, written in 1999. It's still the best book on mercury toxicity. It talks about all the physiological effects that mercury causes and how to address them with micronutrients. So even if you are not interested in chelation, it's still a great book. It's a little bit tough reading if you're not used to sciencey stuff, but it's made for skimming around. So if you go to the back and look up what to take for mercury poisoning, it'll describe all the supplements. You don't need to read it cover to cover. It is hard to read, but well worth it. Then some websites are mercuryexposure.info. This is by a dynamic fellow who is putting everything he can onto the website. He's affiliated with the IAOMT, that's the Anti-Mercury Professional Dental Association, and he's working on a film that looks really interesting that'll be out next year, and It's a great website. It's very large and can be overwhelming with all the material it has in it. A lot of science, a lot of stories. And then there's Dental Amalgam Mercury Solutions, DAMS. This organization is best at doing telephone work. They're who you can call to find out where to find a mercury-free dentist and how to go about amalgam removal. They're sort of a first line of defense, and they are a worthwhile organization that can use your donations. They send out a newsletter a couple times a year, but they're really good at personal support. Then the IAOMT, the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, they just celebrated their 30th anniversary. They were founded by 13 dentists in the early 80s who were aware of the concerns about mercury, and they were alarmed by the lack of science, the lack of evidence that dental amalgams were safe, and the suggestions and indications that they are not safe. So they resolved to form this professional organization to really pursue the science, to fund studies, to conduct studies, and to disseminate that information. And sadly, some of those members seem kind of disillusioned because they really did fulfill their mission of funding and elucidating the science, but the policymakers have not held up their end to get the science into the policy decisions. So it's pretty cynical to see that it's a cynical situation to see that they've been working so hard to improve the science and done such a great job, and yet it's still not reaching the people in terms of the policies or even the information. Then there's a couple journal articles I think are really good for the science readers. Janet Kern has a 2012 article on brain pathology in mercury poisoning, and I understand you'll provide the links to this. True.
Yeah, we'll provide the link to these studies that you mentioned and then these organizations that you've mentioned as well. So those will all be available for everyone who's listening.
And then James Woods has a 2014 article on genetic susceptibilities to mercury. There are 12 that he lists, and the full paper is not open access, but I don't know if you want to list the genes that he studies, or we'll see whatever you'd like to provide. Otherwise, you can go to a university library and download the article for free or pay the publisher to get the article.
Okay. Let's just mention a few of those genes because some people may be familiar with them. The ones that I'm familiar with are the COMT gene, the 5-HTT-LPR, and the APOE, but there's a host of other ones that you had shared with me. So
yeah,
we could probably
that's great
list.
You're familiar with those.
Yeah.
They're pretty obscure to most people. It's not like anything you've heard of except maybe those three that you mentioned.
Yeah. So it would be interesting to see if those genes are available as testing as part of like the 23andMe testing that will measure certain genes. I'm not sure. I know that COMT is on there, but some of these other obscure ones would be interesting to find out how you would go about testing those. So thanks for sharing that.
Yes, and these genes are just the ones that now have human evidence in a controlled study. So there are still a number of genes that it's pretty obvious they affect mercury toxicity or ability to detoxify, like any of the genes that affect methylation, but they're not on this list just because they haven't been studied yet.
Okay, yeah, and that's, as you say, this is an evolving field. We don't have all the information that we need.
Yeah, and then my website that you mentioned, mercuryandmore.weebly.com, and the paper I wrote on the new science, we can have a link to that on your Anxiety Summit website.
Okay, and let's just mention that. I'm going to just mention that name again. It's called New Science Challenges Old Notion That Mercury Dental Amalgam Is Safe, and this was published in January 2014.
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Those are great resources. Thank you for sharing those, because I know a lot of people are going to have a lot of questions, and we really appreciate you for, you know, having dug into all of this and being willing to share all of it. I'd like to end with a few final takeaways.
Yes. Everyone has mercury exposure. Whether it's causing toxicity depends on your genetics, your epigenetics, your total load, and your micronutrient status. And there can be a long latency before toxicity shows up. So understand your exposures from different types of fish and look into safe amalgam removal. And then to address your toxicity, you need lots of antioxidants and cofactors. That means vitamins and minerals. You need more than the average person needs. So the recommendations for the average people don't necessarily apply to you. So start with a diet and supplements. And then finally, please work to help prevent mercury toxicity by raising awareness and by working to help ban the use of mercury in dentistry and medicine.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Chris. It's been fabulous.
My pleasure, Trudy.
I know that we're going to share some of the resources we talked about, and you have offered some additional written material. We're gathering that information, and that will be available via the link that you'll see on the replay page. And, you know, just really, it's been absolutely amazing. I'm just blown away that we had so much material to cover, that we had to do it in two parts. I think it's good that we did it in two parts, because it's a lot of information to digest and absorb. And as Chris says, we've got this mercury exposure. It may be causing issues. It may not be. And just, you know, take this as a good resource so you can learn more, you can feel empowered, you can take charge of your health. Some of this stuff might sound really, really scary, but look at it as a positive thing, as finding, you know, finding a resource and finding solutions to maybe some issues that may have been going on for a long time that you're thinking, what, you know, where's this coming from? Why does this keep happening? So I'm hoping it's provided that level of support for you rather than, totally scaring you and making you feel worse than you're already feeling. And that was not the intention. The intention was to educate and inform, and as Chris says, raise awareness and then stop this use of mercury in dentistry and in the rest of medicine. So any final words, or are we, is that it, Chris?
I think you provide a good example of someone whose symptoms sound like they could be due to mercury, and yet you have been able to overcome that and have a positive success story. And even people like me who are still suffering from chronic mercury poisoning, it's much better to know. It's much better to understand. It's much mm-hmm. better to say, I'm so tired because I've been poisoned. It's not my fault that I'm so tired that I feel unwell. It's environmental pollution that my body wasn't designed for, and mm-hmm. it's not my fault, and I'm empowered to take the measures I know about, and that's all a good thing.
It is. And you are doing a lot better now than you were doing initially when you figured all of this out, correct?
Yes, I've recovered from chronic fatigue and chemical sensitivities. I still do have some brain problems, and that's what's frustrating, but mercury just affects certain parts of the brain, so I still have some cognition to do some reading and writing about this topic.
Well, it's amazing that you've still got issues, and certainly in the brain area, and that you could, you know, get together and, you know, information like this, write a paper, share this information, be part of activism and be wanting to get this message out. So we appreciate you having to learn. It's unfortunate that you had to learn about this the hard way, but we appreciate you sharing this and stepping forward and contacting me and saying you'd like to speak on the summit. And it's been a pleasure having you speak. It's been great getting to know you. I look forward to, you know, getting to know you more. And thank you again so much for sharing this fantastic information.
Thank you, Trudy.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into another amazing call on the Anxiety Summit. This was part two of mercury toxicity being a cause of some of the other causes of anxiety. If you didn't hear part one, I encourage you to go and listen to part one, and then look out for the resources that we are going to share on the blog and on the replay page. Thanks very much for tuning in, and this is Trudy Scott signing off. We will see you on the next call.